It was a fair question, which naturally put me at a disadvantage. I had no idea where to look. Would the limbs be left in the killing room? I didn't think so. It seemed messy to me, and if he wanted to use that same room again, it would be impossible with that kind of nasty clutter lying around. All right. Then I would assume that the rest of the meat had gone somewhere else. But where? Or perhaps, it slowly dawned on me, the real question should be, why? The display of the heads was for a reason. What would be the reason for putting the rest of the bodies somewhere else? Simple concealment? No, nothing was simple with this man, and concealment was evidently not a virtue he prized too highly, especially right now, when he was showing off a bit. That being the case, where would he leave a stack of leftovers? Well, Deborah demanded, how about it? Where should we look? I shook my head. I don't know, I said slowly. Wherever he left the stuff, it's part of his statement. And we're not really sure what his statement is yet, are we? God damn it, Dexter. I know he wants to rub our noses in it. He needs to say that we did something incredibly dumb. And even if we hadn't, he's still smarter than we are. So far, he's right, she said, putting on her grouper face. So, wherever he dumped the stuff, it has to continue that statement. That we're stupid. No, I'm wrong. That we did something stupid. Right. Very important difference. Please, Deb, you'll hurt your face like that. It is important because he's going to comment on the act and not on the actors. Uh-huh. That's really good, Dex. So we should probably head for the nearest dinner theater and look around for an actor with blood up to his elbows, right? I shook my head. No blood, Deb. None at all. That's one of the most important things. How can you be so sure? Because there's been no blood at any of the scenes. That's deliberate, and it's vital to what he's doing. And this time, he'll repeat the important parts, but comment on what he's already done, because we've missed it. Don't you see? Sure, I see. Makes perfect sense. So why don't we go check Office Depot Center? He's probably got the body stacked up in the net again. I opened my mouth to make some wonderfully clever reply. The hockey rink was all wrong, completely and obviously wrong. It had been an experiment, something different, but I knew he wouldn't repeat it. I started to explain this to Deb, that the only reason he would ever repeat the rink would be... I stopped dead, my mouth hanging open. Of course, I thought. Naturally. Now who's making a fish face, huh? What is it, Dex? For a moment, I didn't say anything. I was far too busy trying to catch my whirling thoughts. The only reason he would repeat the hockey rink was to show us we had the wrong guy locked up. Oh, Deb, I said at last. Of course. You're right. The arena. You're right for all the wrong reasons, but still. Beats the hell out of being wrong, she said, and headed for her car. Chapter 21. You do understand it's a long shot, I said. Probably we won't find anything at all. I know that, Deb said. And we don't actually have any jurisdiction here. We're in Broward, and the Broward guys don't like us, so... For Christ's sake, Dexter, she snapped. You're chattering like a schoolgirl. Perhaps that was true, although it was very unkind of her to say so. And Deborah, on the other hand, appeared to be a bundle of steely, tightly wrapped nerves. As we turned off the Sawgrass Expressway and drove into the parking lot of the Office Depot Center, she bit down harder. I could almost hear her jaw creak. Dirty Harriet, I said to myself, but apparently Deb was eavesdropping. Fuck off, she said. I looked from Deborah's granite profile to the arena. For one brief moment, with the early morning sunlight hitting it just right, it looked like the building was surrounded by a fleet of flying saucers. Of course, it was only the outdoor lighting fixtures that sprouted around the arena like oversized steel toadstools. Someone must have told the architect they were distinctive. Youthful and vigorous, too, most likely. And I'm sure they were, in the right light. I did hope they would find the right light sometime soon. We drove one time around the arena, looking for signs of life. On the second circuit, a battered Toyota pulled up beside one of the doors. The passenger door was held closed with a loop of rope that ran out the window and around the doorpost. Opening the driver's door as she parked, Deborah was already stepping out of the car while it was still rolling. "Excuse me, sir," she said to the man getting out of the Toyota. He was 50, a squat guy in ratty green pants and a blue nylon jacket. He glanced at Deb in her uniform and was instantly nervous.
"What?"
he said.
"I didn't do nothing."
"Do you work here, sir?"
"Sure. Of course. Why you think I'm here 8 o'clock in the morning?"
"What's your name, please, sir?" He fumbled for his wallet.
"Esteban Rodriguez. I got an ID."
Deborah waved that off. "That's not necessary," she said. "What are you doing here at this hour, sir?" He shrugged and pushed his wallet back into the pocket.
"I supposed to be here earlier most days, but the team is on the road, Vancouver, Ottawa, and L.A., so I get here a little later."
"Is anyone else here right now, Esteban?"
"No, just me. They all sleep late."
"What about at night? Is there a guard?" He waved an arm around.
"The security goes around the parking lot at night, but not too much. I'm the first one here most days."
"The first one to go inside, you mean?"
"Yeah, that's right. What I say?"
I climbed out of the car and leaned across the roof. "Are you the guy who drives the Zamboni for the morning skate?" I asked him. Deb glanced at me, annoyed. Esteban peered at me, taking in my natty Hawaiian shirt and gabardine slacks.
"What kind of cop you are, huh?"
"I'm a nerd cop," I said. "I just work in the lab."
"Oh, sure," he said,
nodding his head as if that made sense. "Do you run the Zamboni, Esteban?" I repeated.
"Yeah, you know. They don't let me drive her in the games, you know. That's for the guys with suits. They like to put a kid, you know, some celebrity maybe, ride around and wave, that shit. But I get to do it for the morning skate, you know, when the team is in town. I run the Zamboni just the morning, real early. But they're on the road now, so I come later."
"We'd like to take a look inside the arena," Deb said, clearly impatient with me for speaking out of turn. Esteban turned back to her, a crafty gleam lighting up half of one eye.
"Sure," he said. "You got a warrant?"
Deborah blushed. It made a wonderful contrast to the blue of her uniform, but it was possibly not the most effective choice for reinforcing her authority. And because I knew her well, I knew she would realize she had blushed and get mad. Since we didn't have a warrant, and didn't, in fact, have any business here whatsoever that could remotely be considered officially sanctioned, I didn't think that getting mad was our best tactical maneuver. "Esteban," I said, before Deb could say anything regrettable.
"Huh?
How long have you worked here?" He shrugged.
"Since the place opened. I worked at the old arena 2 years before that."
"So you were working here last week when they found the dead body on the ice?" Esteban looked away. Under his tan, his face turned green. He swallowed hard.
"I never want to see something like that again, man," he said. "Never."
I nodded with genuine synthetic sympathy. "I really don't blame you," I said. "And that's why we're here, Esteban." He frowned.
"Why you mean?"
I glanced at Deb to make sure she wasn't drawing a weapon or anything. She glared at me with tight-lipped disapproval and tapped her foot. But she didn't say anything. "Esteban," I said, moving a little closer to the man and making my voice as confidential and manly as I could. "We think there's a chance that when you open those doors this morning, you might find the same kind of thing waiting for you."
"Shit!" he exploded. "I don't want nothing to do with that."
"Of course you don't.
Me cago en diez with that shit," he said.
"Exactly," I agreed. "So why not let us take a peek first, just to be sure?" He gaped at me for a moment, then at Deborah, who was still scowling. A very striking look for her, nicely set off by her uniform.
"I could get in trouble," he said. "Lose my job."
I smiled with authentic-looking sympathy. "Or you could go inside and find a stack of chopped-up arms and legs all by yourself. A lot more of them this time."
"Shit," he said again. "I get in trouble, lose my job, huh? Why should I do that, huh?
How about civic duty?"
"Come on, man," he said. "Don't fuck with me. What do you care about if I lose my job?"
He didn't actually hold out his hand, which I thought was very genteel, but it was clear that he hoped for a small present to insulate him against the possible loss of his job. Very reasonable, considering that this was Miami. But all I had was $5, and I really needed to get a cruller and a cup of coffee. So I just nodded with manly understanding. "You're right," I said. "We hoped you wouldn't have to see all the body parts. Did I say there were quite a few this time? But I certainly don't want you to lose your job. Sorry to bother you, Stabon. Have a nice day." I smiled at Deborah. "Let's go, officer. We should get back to the other scene and search for the fingers." Deborah was still scowling, but at least she had the native wit to play along. She opened her car door as I cheerfully waved to Stabon and climbed in.
"Wait!"
Stabon called. I glanced at him with an expression of polite interest.
"I swear to God, I don't want to find that shit ever again," he said.
He looked at me for a moment, perhaps hoping I would loosen up and hand him a fistful of Krugerrands, but as I said, that cruller was weighing heavily on my mind, and I didn't relent. Stabon licked his lips, then turned away quickly and jammed a key into the lock of the large double door.
"Go ahead. I wait out here."
"If you're sure," I said.
"Come on, man. What you want from me? Go ahead."
I stood up and smiled at Deborah.
"He's sure,"
I said. She just shook her head at me, a strange combination of little sister exasperation and cop sour humor. She walked around the car and led the way in through the door, and I followed. Inside, the arena was cool and dark, which shouldn't have surprised me. It was, after all, a hockey rink early in the morning. No doubt Stabon knew where the light switch was, but he hadn't offered to tell us. Deb unsnapped the large flashlight from her belt and swung the beam around the ice. I held my breath as the light picked out one goalie's net, then the other. She swept back around the perimeter one time, slowly, pausing once or twice, then back to me.
"Nothing," she said. "Jack shit."
"You sound disappointed." She snorted at me and headed back out. I stayed in the middle of the rink, feeling the cool radiate up off the ice and thinking my happy thoughts. Or, more precisely, not quite my happy thoughts. Because as Deb turned to go out, I heard a small voice from somewhere over my shoulder, a cool and dry chuckle, a familiar feather touch just under the threshold of hearing. And as dear Deborah departed, I stood motionless there on the ice, closed my eyes and listened to what my ancient friend had to say. It wasn't much, just a sub-whisper, a hint of unvocal, but I listened. I heard him chuckle and mutter soft and terrible things in one ear, while the other ear let me know that Deborah had told Stabon to come in and turn on the lights, which moments later he did, as the small, off-voice whisper rose in a sudden crescendo of rattling jolly humor and good-natured horror.
"What is it?"
I asked politely. My only answer was a surge of hungry amusement. I had no idea what it meant. But I wasn't greatly surprised when the screaming started. Stabon was really terrible at screaming. It was a hoarse, strangled grunting that sounded more like he was being violently sick than anything else. The man brought no sense of music to the job. I opened my eyes. It was impossible to concentrate under these circumstances, and anyway, there was nothing more to hear. The whispering had stopped when the screaming began. After all, the screams said it all, didn't they? And so I opened my eyes just in time to see Stabon catapult out of the little closet at the far end of the arena and vault onto the rink. He went clattering across the ice, slipping and sliding and moaning hoarsely in Spanish, and finally hurling headlong into the boards. He scrabbled up and skittered toward the door, grunting with horror. A small splotch of blood smeared the ice where he had fallen. Deborah came quickly through the door, her gun drawn, and Stabon clawed past her, stumbling out into the light of day.
"What is it?"
Deborah said, holding her weapon ready. I tilted my head, hearing one last echo of the final dry chuckle. And now, with the grunting horror still ringing in my ears, I understood. "I believe Stabon has found something," I said. Chapter 22. Police politics, as I had tried so hard to impress on Deborah, was a slippery and many-tentacled thing. And when you brought together two law enforcement organizations that really didn't care for each other, mutual operations tended to go very slowly, very much by the book, and with a good deal of foot-dragging, excuse-making, and veiled insults and threats. All great fun to watch, of course, but it did draw out the proceedings just a trifle more than necessary. Consequently, it was several hours after Stabon's dreadful yodeling exhibition before the jurisdictional squabbling was straightened out, and our team actually began to examine the happy little surprise our new friend Stabon had discovered when he opened the closet door. During that time, Deborah stood off to one side for the most part, working very hard at controlling her impatience, but not terribly hard at hiding it. Captain Matthews arrived with Detective LaGuerta in tow. They shook hands with their Broward County counterparts, Captain Moon and Detective McClellan. There was a lot of barely polite sparring, which boiled down to this. Matthews was reasonably certain that the discovery of six arms and six legs in Broward was part of his department's investigation of three heads lacking the same pieces in Miami-Dade. He stated, in terms that were far too friendly and simple, that it seemed a bit far-fetched to think that he would find three heads without bodies, and then three totally different bodies without heads would turn up here. Moon and McClellan, with equal logic, pointed out that people found heads in Miami all the time, but in Broward it was a little more unusual, and so maybe they took it a bit more seriously. And anyway, there was no way to know for sure they were connected until some preliminary work had been done, which clearly ought to be done by them, since it was in their jurisdiction. Of course, they would cheerfully pass on the results. And, of course, that was unacceptable to Matthews. He explained carefully that the Broward people didn't know what to look for and might miss something or destroy a piece of key evidence. Not, of course, through incompetence or stupidity. Matthews was quite sure the Broward people were perfectly competent, considering. This was naturally not taken in a cheerful spirit of cooperation by Moon, who observed with a little bit of feeling that this seemed to imply that his department was full of second-rate morons. By this point, Captain Matthews was mad enough to reply much too politely, "Oh no, not second-rate at all." I'm sure it would have ended in a fistfight if the gentleman from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement hadn't arrived to referee. The FDLE is a sort of state-level FBI. They have jurisdiction anywhere in the state at any time, and unlike the feds, they are respected by most of the local cops. The officer in question was a man of average height and build, with a shaved head and a close-cropped beard. He didn't really seem out of the ordinary to me, but when he stepped between the two much larger police captains, they instantly shut up and took a step back. In short order, he had things settled down and organized, and we got quickly back to being the neat and well-ordered scene of multiple homicide. The man from FDLE had ruled that it was Miami-Dade's investigation unless and until tissue samples proved the body parts here and the heads down there were unrelated. In practical and immediate terms, this meant that Captain Matthews got to have his picture taken first by the mob of reporters already clustering outside. Angel No Relation arrived and went to work. I wasn't at all sure what to make of it, and I don't mean the jurisdictional squabbling. No. I was far more concerned with the event itself, which had left me with a great deal to think about. Not merely the fact of the killings and the redistribution of the meat, which was piquant enough, but I had, of course, managed to sneak a peek into Stabon's little closet of horrors earlier, before the troops arrived. Can you blame me, really? I had only wanted to sample the carnage and try to understand why my dear unknown business associate had chosen to stack the leftovers there. Truly, just a quick look-see. So immediately after Stabon had skidded out the door, squealing and grunting like a pig choking on a grapefruit, I had skipped eagerly back to the closet to see what had set him off. The parts were not wrapped carefully this time. Instead, they were laid out on the floor in four groups. And as I looked closer, I realized a wonderful thing. One leg had been laid straight along the left-hand side of the closet. It was a pale, bloodless blue-white, and around the ankle there was even a small gold chain with a heart-shaped trinket. Very cute, really. Unspoiled by awful bloodstains. Truly elegant work. Two dark arms, equally well cut, had been bent at the elbow and placed alongside the leg, with the elbow pointing away. Right next to this, the remaining limbs, all bent at the joint, had been arranged in two large circles. It took me a moment. I blinked, and suddenly it swam into focus, and I had to frown very hard to keep myself from giggling out loud like the schoolgirl Deb had accused me of being. Because he had arranged the arms and legs in letters, and the letters spelled out a single small word. Boo. The three torsos were carefully arranged below the boo in a quarter circle, making a cute little Halloween smile. What a scamp. But even as I admired the playful spirit this prank exposed, I wondered why he had chosen to put the display here, in a closet, instead of out on the ice where it could gain the recognition of a wider audience. It was a very spacious closet, granted, but still, close quarters, just enough room for the display. So why? And as I wondered, the outer door of the arena swung open with a clatter, the first of the arriving rescue team, no doubt, and the door, crashing wide, sent, a moment later, a draft of cool air over the ice and onto my back. The cold air went over my spine and was answered by a flow of warmth moving upward along the same pathway. It ran light-fingered up into the unlit bottom of my consciousness, and something changed somewhere deep in the moonless night of my lizard brain, and I felt the dark passenger agree violently with something that I didn't even hear or understand, except that it had to do somehow with the primal urgency of cool air and the walls closing in, and an attacking sense of rightness. No question about it. Something here was just plain right, and made my obscure hitchhiker pleased and excited and satisfied in a way I didn't begin to understand. And floating in above all that was the strange notion that this was very familiar. None of it made any sense to me, but there it was. And before I could explore these strange revelations any further, I was being urged by a squat young man in a blue uniform to step away and keep my hands in plain sight. No doubt he was the first of the arriving troops, and he was holding his weapon on me in a very convincing way. Since he had only one dark eyebrow running all the way across his face and no apparent forehead, I decided it would be a very good idea to go along with his wishes. He looked to be just the sort of dull-witted brute who might shoot an innocent person, or even me. I stepped away from the closet. Unfortunately, my retreat revealed the little diorama in the closet, and the young man was suddenly very busy finding some place to put his breakfast. He made it to a large trash can about 10 feet away before commencing his ugly blarging sounds. I stood quite still and waited for him to finish. Nasty habit, hurling half-digested food around like that. So unsanitary. And this was a guardian of public safety, too. More uniforms trotted in, and soon my simian friend had several buddies sharing the trash can with him. The noise was extremely unpleasant, to say nothing of the smell now wafting my way. But I waited politely for them to finish, since one of the fascinating things about a handgun is that it can be fired almost as well by someone who is throwing up. But one of the uniforms eventually straightened up, wiped his face on his sleeve, and began to question me. I was soon sorted out and pushed over to one side with instructions not to go anywhere or touch anything. Captain Matthews and Detective LaGuerta had arrived soon after, and when they finally took over the scene, I relaxed a bit. But now that I could actually go somewhere and touch something, I simply sat and thought. And the things I thought about were surprisingly troublesome. Why had the display in the closet seemed familiar? Unless I was going to return to my idiocy of earlier in the day and persuade myself that I had done this, I was at a loss as to why it should seem so delightfully unsurprising. Of course I hadn't done it. I was already ashamed of the stupidity of that notion. Boo indeed. It was not even worth taking the time to scoff at the idea. Ridiculous. So, why did it seem familiar? I sighed and experienced one more new feeling. Befuddlement. I simply had no notion of what was going on, except that somehow I was a part of it. This didn't seem a terribly helpful revelation, since it matched exactly all my other closely reasoned analytical conclusions so far. If I ruled out the absurd idea that I had done this without knowing it, and I did, then each subsequent explanation became even more unlikely. And so Dexter's summary of the case reads as follows. He is involved somehow, but doesn't even know what that means. I could feel the little wheels in my once proud brain leaping off their tracks and clattering to the floor. Clang, clang. Whee. Dexter derailed. Luckily, I was saved from complete collapse by the appearance of dear Deborah. Come on, she said brusquely. We're going upstairs. May I ask why? We're going to talk to the office staff, she said. See if they know anything. They must know something if they have an office, I offered. She looked at me for a moment, then turned away. Come on, she said. It may have been the commanding tone in her voice, but I went. We walked to the far side of the arena from where I had been sitting and into the lobby. A Broward cop stood beside the elevator there, and just outside the long row of glass doors, I could see several more of them standing at a barrier. Deb marched up to the cop at the elevator and said, I'm Morgan. He nodded and pushed the up button. He looked at me with a lack of expression that said a great deal. I'm Morgan, too, I told him. He just looked at me, then turned his head away to stare out the glass doors. There was a muted chime, and the elevator arrived. Deborah stalked in and slammed her hand against the button hard enough to make the cop look up at her, and the door slid shut. Why so glum, sis? I asked her. Isn't this what you wanted to do? It's make work, and everybody knows it, she snarled. But it's detective-type make work, I pointed out. That bitch LaGuerta stuck her oar in, she hissed. As soon as I'm done spinning my wheels here, I have to go back out on hooker duty. Oh, dear. In your little sex suit? In my little sex suit, she said. And before I could really formulate any magical words of consolation, we arrived at the office level, and the elevator doors slid open. Deb stalked out, and I followed. We soon found the staff lounge where the office workers had been herded to wait until the full majesty of the law had the time to get around to them. Another Broward cop stood at the door of the lounge, presumably to make certain that none of the staff made a break for the Canadian border. Deborah nodded to the cop at the door and went into the lounge. I trailed behind her without much enthusiasm and let my mind wander over my problem. A moment later, I was startled out of my reverie when Deborah jerked her head at me and led a surly, greasy-faced young man with long and awful hair toward the door. I followed again. She was naturally separating him from the others for questioning. Very good police procedure. But to be perfectly honest, it didn't light a fire in my heart. I knew, without knowing why, that none of these people had anything meaningful to contribute. Judging from this first specimen, it was probably safe to apply that generalization to his life as well as to this murder. This was just dull routine make-work that had been doled out to Deb because the captain thought she had done something good, but she was still a pest. So he had sent her away with a piece of real detective drudgery to keep her busy and out of sight. And I had been dragged with her because Deb wanted me along. Possibly she wanted to see if my fantastic ESP powers could help determine what these office sheep had eaten for breakfast. One look at this young gentleman's complexion, and I was fairly sure he had eaten cold pizza, potato chips, and a liter of Pepsi. It had ruined his complexion and given him an air of vacuous hostility. Still, I followed along as Mr. Grumpy directed Deborah to a conference room at the back of the building. There was a long oak table with 10 black high-backed chairs in the center of the room, and a desk in the corner with a computer and some audio-visual equipment. As Deb and her pimply young friend sat and began trading frowns, I wandered over to the desk. A small bookshelf sat under the window beside the desk. I looked out the window. Almost directly below me, I could see the growing crowd of reporters and squad cars that now surrounded the door where we had gone in with Staban. I looked at the bookshelf, thinking I would clear a small space and lean there, tastefully away from the conversation. There was a stack of manila folders, and perched on top of it was a small gray object. It was squarish and looked to be plastic. A black wire ran from the thing over to the back of the computer. I picked it up to move it.
"Hey," the surly geek said, "don't mess with the webcam."
I looked at Deb. She looked at me, and I swear I saw her nostrils flare like a racehorse at the starting gate. "The what?" she said quietly.
"I had it focused down on the entrance," he said. "Now I gotta refocus it. Man, why do you have to mess with my stuff?"
"He said webcam," I said to Deborah. "A camera," she said to me. "Yes." She turned to young Prince Charming. "Is it on?" He gaped at her, still concentrating on maintaining his righteous frown.
"What?"
"The camera," Deborah said. "Does it work?" He snorted and then wiped his nose with a finger.
"What do you think? I would get all worked up if it didn't? $200. It totally works."
I looked out the window where the camera had been pointing as he droned on in his surly grumble.
"I got a website and everything. Cathouse.com. People can watch the team when they get here and when they leave."
Deborah drifted over and stood beside me, looking out the window. "It was pointed at the door," I said.
"Duh," our happy pal said. "How else are people on the website going to see the team?"
Deborah turned and looked at him. After about 5 seconds, he blushed and dropped his eyes to the table. "Was the camera turned on last night?" she said. He didn't look up, just mumbled,
"Sure, I mean, I guess so."
Deborah turned to me. Her computer knowledge was confined to knowing enough to fill out standardized traffic reports. She knew I was a little more savvy. "How do you have it set up?" I asked the top of the young man's head. "Do the images automatically archive?" This time he looked up. I'd used archive as a verb, so I must be okay.
"Yeah," he said. "It refreshes every 15 seconds and just dumps to the hard drive. I usually erase in the morning."
Deborah actually clutched my arm hard enough to break the skin.
"Did you erase this morning?" she asked him.
He glanced away again.
"No," he said. "You guys came stomping in and yelling and stuff. I didn't even get to check my email."
Deborah looked at me.
"Bingo," I said.
"Come here,"
she said to our unhappy camper.
"Huh?"
he said.
"Come here," she repeated,
and he stood up slowly, mouth hanging open, and rubbed his knuckles.
"What?"
he said.
"Could you please come over here, sir?"
Deborah ordered with truly veteran cop technique, and he stuttered into motion and came over.
"Can we see the pictures from last night, please?"
He gaped at the computer, then at her.
"Why?"
he said.
"Ah,"
The Mysteries of Human Intelligence.
Because, Deborah said, very slowly and carefully, I think you might have taken a picture of the killer.
He stared at her and blinked, then blushed.
No way, he said.
Way, I told him.
He stared at me, then at Deb, his jaw hanging open.
Awesome, he breathed. No shit. I mean, no, really? I mean...
He blushed even harder. Can we look at the pictures? Deb said. He stood still for a second, then plunged into the chair at the desk and touched the mouse. Immediately, the screen came to life, and he began typing and mouse-clicking furiously.
What time should I start?
What time did everybody leave? Deborah asked him. He shrugged.
We were empty last night. Everybody gone by, what, 8 o'clock?
Start at midnight, I said, and he nodded.
"'Kay," he said.
He worked quietly for a moment, then...
Come on, he grumbled. It's only like a 600 megahertz, he said. They won't update. They keep saying it's fine, but so freaking slow, and it won't...
Okay, he said, breaking off suddenly. A dark image appeared on the monitor, the empty parking lot below us.
Midnight, he said, and stared at the screen.
After 15 seconds, the picture changed to the same picture.
Do we have to watch 5 hours of this? Deborah asked.
Scroll through, I said. Look for headlights or something moving.
Right, he said.
He did some rapid point and click, and the pictures began to flip past at 1 per second. They didn't change much at first. The same dark parking lot. One bright light out at the edge of the picture. After about 50 frames had clicked past, an image jumped into view.
A truck, Deborah said.
Our pet nerd shook his head.
Security, he said.
And in the next frame, the security car was visible. He kept scrolling, and the pictures rolled by. Eternal and unchanging. Every 30 or 40 frames, we would see the security truck pass, and then nothing. After several minutes of this, the pattern stopped, and there was a long stretch of nothing.
Busted, my greasy new friend said.
Deborah gave him a hard look. The camera is broken? He looked up at her, blushed again, and looked away.
The security dudes, he explained. They totally suck. Every night at, like, 3, they park over at the other side and go to sleep.
He nodded at the unchanging pictures scrolling past.
See? Hello, Mr. Security Dude. Hard at work?
He made a wet sound deep in his nose that I had to assume was meant to be laughter.
Not very.
He repeated the snorting sound and started the pictures scrolling again. And then suddenly,
wait,
I called out. On screen, a van popped into view at the door below us. There was another pop as the image changed, and a man stood beside the truck.
Can you make it go closer? Deborah asked.
Zoom in, I said, before he could do more than frown a little. He moved the cursor, highlighted the dark figure on the screen, and clicked the mouse. The picture jumped to a closer look.
You're not going to get much more resolution, he said. The pixels...
Shut up, said Deborah. She was staring at the screen hard enough to melt it, and as I stared too, I could see why. It was dark, and the man was still too far away to be certain. But from the few details I could make out, there was something oddly familiar about him. The way he stood frozen in the image on the computer, his weight balanced on both feet, and the overall impression of the profile. Somehow, as vague as it was, it added up to something. And as a very loud wave of sibilant chuckling erupted from deep in the back seat of my brain, it fell on me with the impact of a concert grand piano that, actually, he looked an awful lot like...
Dexter?
Deborah said, in a sort of hushed and strangled croak. Yes, indeed. Just like Dexter. Chapter 23. I'm pretty sure that Deborah took young Mr. Bad Hair Day back to the lounge, because when I looked up again, she was standing in front of me, alone.
In spite of her blue uniform, she didn't look at all like a cop right now. She looked worried, like she couldn't decide whether to yell or to cry, like a mommy whose special little boy had let her down in a big way. "Well?" she demanded, and I had to agree that she had a point.
"Not terribly," I said. "You?"
She kicked a chair. It fell over. "God damn it, Dexter. Don't give me that clever shit. Tell me something. Tell me that wasn't you."
I didn't say anything.
"Well, then, tell me it is you. Just tell me something. Anything at all."
I shook my head. There was really nothing to say, so I just shook my head again.
"I'm pretty sure it isn't me," I said. "I mean, I don't think so."
Even to me, that sounded like I had both feet firmly planted in the land of lame answers.
"What does that mean, pretty sure?" Deb demanded. "Does that mean you're not sure? Then it might be you in that picture?"
"Well," I said, "a truly brilliant riposte, considering." "Maybe. I don't know."
"And does I don't know mean you don't know whether you're going to tell me, or does it mean that you really don't know if that's you in the picture?"
"I'm pretty sure it isn't me, Deborah," I repeated, "but I really don't know for sure." "It looks like me, doesn't it?"
"Shit," she said,
and kicked the chair where it lay. It slammed into the table.
"How can you not know, goddammit?"
"It is a little tough to explain."
"Try."
I opened my mouth, but for once in my life, nothing came out. As if everything else wasn't bad enough, I seemed to be all out of clever, too. I've been having these dreams, but, Deb, I really don't know," I said. And I may have actually mumbled it.
"Shit, shit, shit," said Deborah.
Kick, kick, kick. And it was very hard to disagree with her analysis of the situation. All my stupid, self-mutilating musings swam back at me with a bright and mocking edge. Of course it wasn't me. How could it be me? Wouldn't I know it if it was me?
Apparently not, dear boy. Apparently you didn't actually know anything at all, because our deep, dark, dim little brains tell us all kinds of things that swim in and out of reality. But pictures don't lie.
Deb unleashed a new volley of savage attacks on the chair, and then straightened up. Her face was flushed very red, and her eyes looked more like Harry's eyes than they ever had before.
"All right," she said. "It's like this."
And she blinked and paused for a moment as it occurred to both of us that she had just said a Harry thing. And for a second, Harry was there in the room between me and Deborah. The two of us so very different, and yet still both Harry's kids, the two strange fists of his unique legacy. Some of the steel went out of Deb's back, and she looked human, a thing I hadn't seen for a while. She stared at me for a long moment, and then turned away.
"You're my brother, Dex," she said.
I was very sure that was not what she had originally intended to say.
"No one will blame you," I told her. "God damn you, you're my brother!" she snarled, and the ferocity of it took me completely by surprise. "I don't know what went on with you and Dad, the stuff you two never talked about, but I know what he would have done."
"Turned me in," I said, and Deborah nodded. Something glittered in the corner of her eye.
"You're all the family I have, Dex."
"Not such a great bargain for you, is it?" She turned to me, and I could see tears in both eyes now. For a long moment, she just looked at me. I watched the tear run from her left eye and roll down her cheek. She wiped it, straightened up, and took a deep breath, turning away to the window once again.
"That's right," she said. "He would have turned you in, which is what I'm going to do."
She looked away from me out the window, far out to the horizon.
"I have to finish these interviews," she said. "I'm leaving you in charge of determining if this evidence is relevant. Take it to your computer at home and figure out whatever you have to figure out. And when I'm done here, before I go back out on duty, I'm coming to get it, to hear what you have to say."
She glanced at her watch.
8 o'clock. And if I have to take you in then, I will. She looked back at me for a long moment. God damn it, Dexter, she said softly. And she left the room. I moved over to the window and had a look for myself. Below me, the circus of cops and reporters and gawking geeks was swirling, unchanged. Far away, beyond the parking lot, I could see the expressway, filled with cars and trucks blasting along at the Miami speed limit of 95 miles per hour. And beyond that, in the dim distance, was the high-rise skyline of Miami. And here in the foreground stood dim, dazed Dexter, staring out the window at a city that didn't speak and wouldn't have told him anything even if it did. God damn it, Dexter. I don't know how long I stared out the window, but it eventually occurred to me that there were no answers out there. There might be some, though, on Captain Pimple's computer. I turned to the desk. The machine had a CDRW drive. In the top drawer, I found a box of recordable CDs. I put one into the drive, copied the entire file of pictures, and took the CD out. I held it, glanced at it. It didn't have much to say, and I probably imagined the faint chuckling I thought I heard from the dark voice in the back seat. But just to be safe, I wiped the file from the hard drive. On my way out, the Broward cops on duty didn't stop me, or even speak, but it did seem to me that they looked at me with a very hard and suspicious indifference. I wondered if this was what it felt like to have a conscience. I supposed I would never really know. Unlike poor Deborah, being torn apart by far too many loyalties that couldn't possibly live together in the same brain. I admired her solution, leaving me in charge of determining if the evidence was relevant. Very neat. It had a very hairy feel to it, like leaving a loaded gun on the table in front of a guilty friend and walking away, knowing that guilt would pull the trigger and save the city the cost of a trial. In Harry's world, a man's conscience couldn't live with that kind of shame. But as Harry had known very well, his world was long dead, and I didn't have any conscience, shame, or guilt. All I had was a CD with a few pictures on it. And of course, those pictures made even less sense than a conscience. There had to be some explanation that didn't involve Dexter driving a truck around Miami in his sleep. Of course, most of the drivers on the road seemed to manage it, but they were at least partially awake when they started out, weren't they? And here I was, all bright-eyed and cheerfully alert, and not at all the kind of guy who would ever prowl the city and kill unconsciously. No, I was the kind of guy who wanted to be awake for every moment of it. And to get right down to the bottom line, there was the night on the causeway. It was physically impossible that I could have thrown the head at my own car, wasn't it? Unless I had made myself believe that I could be in two places at once, which made a great deal of sense, considering that the only alternative I could come up with was believing that I only thought I'd been sitting there in my car watching someone else throw the head, when in fact I had actually thrown the head at my own car, and then... No. Ridiculous. I couldn't ask the last few shreds of my brain to believe in this kind of fairy tale. There would be some very simple, logical explanation, and I would find it. And even though I sounded like a man trying to convince himself that there was nothing under the bed, I said it out loud. There is a simple, logical explanation, I said to myself. And because you never know who else is listening, I added, and there is nothing under the bed. But once again, the only reply was a very meaningful silence from the dark passenger. In spite of the usual cheerful bloodlust of the other drivers, I found no answers on the drive home. Or to be perfectly truthful, I found no answers that made sense. There were plenty of stupid answers, but they all revolved around the same central premise, which was that all was not well inside the skull of our favorite monster, and I found this very hard to accept. Perhaps it was only that I didn't feel any crazier than I had ever felt. I didn't notice any missing gray tissue. I didn't seem to be thinking any slower or more strangely. And so far, I'd had no conversations with invisible buddies that I was aware of.
Except in my sleep, of course. And did that really count? Weren't we all crazy in our sleep? What was sleep, after all, but the process by which we dumped our insanity into a dark subconscious pit and came out on the other side ready to eat cereal instead of the neighbor's children? And aside from the dreams I'd had, everything made sense. Someone else had thrown the head at me on the causeway, left a Barbie in my apartment, and arranged the bodies in intriguing ways. Someone else, not me. Someone other than dear Dark Dexter. And that someone else was finally captured, right here, in the pictures on this CD. And I would look at the pictures and prove once and for all that it looked very much like the killer might be me? Good, Dexter. Very good. I told you there was a logical explanation. Someone else who was actually me. Of course. That made wonderful sense, didn't it? I got home and peeked into my apartment carefully. There didn't appear to be anyone waiting for me. There was no reason why there should have been, of course. But knowing that this arch-fiend who was terrorizing the metropolis knew where I lived was a little unsettling. He had proven he was the kind of monster who might do anything. He could even come in and leave more doll parts at any time. Especially if he was me. Which, of course, he was not. Certainly not. The pictures would show some small something to prove that the resemblance was only coincidental, and the fact that I was so strangely attuned to the murders was also coincidental, no doubt. Yes, this was clearly a series of perfectly logical, monstrous coincidences. Perhaps I should call the Guinness Book people. I wonder what the world record was for not being sure whether you committed a string of murders. I put on a Philip Glass CD and sat in my chair. The music stirred the emptiness inside of me, and after a few minutes, something like my usual calm and icy logic returned. I went to my computer and turned it on. I put the CD into the drive and looked at the pictures. I zoomed in and out and did everything I knew how to do in an attempt to clean up the images. I tried things I had only heard about and things that I made up on the spot, and nothing worked. At the end, I was no further along than I had been when I started. It was just not possible to get enough resolution to make the face of the man in the picture come clear. Still, I stared at the pictures. I moved them around to different angles. I printed them out and held them up to the light. I did everything a normal person would do, and while I was pleased with my imitation, I didn't discover anything except that the man in the picture looked like me. I just couldn't get a clear impression of anything, even his clothing. He wore a shirt that could have been white, or tan, or yellow, or even light blue. The parking lot light that shone on him was one of the bright argon anti-crime lights, and it cast a pinkish-orange glow. Between that and the lack of resolution in the picture, it was impossible to tell any more. His pants were long, loosely cut, light-colored. Altogether a standard outfit that anyone might have worn, including me. I had clothing just like it several times over, enough to outfit an entire platoon of Dexter lookalikes. I did manage to zoom in on the side of the truck enough to make out the letter A, and below it a B, followed by an R, and either a C or an O. But the truck was angled away from the camera, and that was all I could see. None of the other pictures offered me any hints. I watched the sequence again. The man vanished, reappeared, and then the van was gone. No good angles, no fortuitous accidental glimpses of his license plate, and no reason to say with any authority that either it was or was not deftly dreaming Dexter. When I finally looked up from the computer, night had come, and it was dark outside. And I did what a normal person almost certainly would have done several hours ago. I quit. There was nothing else I could do except wait for Deborah. I would have to let my poor, tormented sister haul me away to jail. After all, one way or another, I was guilty. I really should be locked up. Perhaps I could even share a cell with Mikhail. He could teach me the rat dance. And with that thought, I did a truly wonderful thing. I fell asleep. Chapter 24. I had no dreams, no sense of traveling outside my body. I saw no parade of ghostly images or headless, bloodless bodies. No visions of sugar plums danced in my head. There was nothing there, not even me. Nothing but a dark and timeless sleep. And yet when the telephone woke me up, I knew that the call was about Deborah, and I knew that she wasn't coming. My hand was already sweating as I grabbed up the receiver. Yes, I said.
This is Captain Matthews, the voice said. I need to speak to Detective Morgan, please.
She isn't here, I said, a small part of me sinking from the thought and what it meant.
That's not... When did she leave?
I glanced at the clock instinctively. It was 9:15, and I fell deeper into the sweats. She was never here, I told the captain.
But she signed out to your place. She's on duty. She's supposed to be there.
She never got here.
Well, goddamn it, he said. She said you have some evidence we need.
I do, I said. And I hung up the telephone. I did have some evidence. I was terribly sure of that. I just didn't quite know what it was. But I had to figure it out, and I didn't think I had a great deal of time. Or to be more accurate, I didn't think Deb had a great deal of time. And again, I wasn't aware of how I knew this. I didn't consciously say to myself, "He has Deborah." No alarming pictures of her impending fate popped into my brain. And I didn't have to experience any blinding insights or think, "Gee, Deb should have been here by now. This is unlike her." I simply knew, as I had known when I woke up, that Deb had come for me, and she hadn't made it. And I knew what that meant. He had her. He had taken her entirely for my benefit, this I knew. He had been circling closer and closer to me, coming into my apartment, writing small messages with his victims, teasing me with hints and glimpses of what he was doing. And now he was as close as he could get without being in the same room. He had taken Deb, and he was waiting with her. Waiting for me. But where? And how long would he wait before he became impatient and started to play without me? And without me, I knew very well who his playmate would be. Deborah. She had turned up at my place dressed for work in her hooker outfit, absolutely gift-wrapped for him. He must have thought it was Christmas. He had her, and she would be his special friend tonight. I didn't want to think of her like that, taped and stretched tight and watching slow, awful pieces of herself disappear forever. But that was how it would be. Under other circumstances, it might make a wonderful evening's entertainment, but not with Deborah. I was pretty sure I didn't want that. Didn't want him to do anything permanent and wonderful. Not tonight. Later, perhaps. With someone else. When we knew each other a little better. But not now. Not with Deborah. And with that thought, of course, everything seemed better. It was just so nice to have that settled. I preferred my sister alive, rather than in small, bloodless sections. Lovely. Almost human of me. Now that was settled. What next? I could call Rita. Perhaps take in a movie, or a walk in the park, or let's see, maybe, I don't know, save Deborah? Yes, that sounded like fun, but how? I had a few clues, of course. I knew the way he thought. After all, I had been thinking that way myself, and he wanted me to find him. He'd been sending that message loud and clear. If I could put all the distracting stupidity out of my head, all the dreams and New Age fairy chasing and everything else, then I was certain that I could arrive at the logical and correct location. He wouldn't have taken Deb unless he thought he had given me everything a clever monster would need to know in order to find him. All right, then, clever Dexter. Find him. Track down the Deb Napper. Let your relentless logic slash across the back trail like an icy wolf pack. Kick the giant brain into high gear. Let the wind race across the rocketing synapses of your powerful mind as it speeds to its beautiful, inevitable conclusion. Go, Dexter, go. Dexter?
Hello? Is anybody in there?
Apparently not. I heard no wind from rocketing synapses. I was as empty as if I had never been. There was no swirl of debilitating emotions, of course, since I didn't have any emotions to swirl. But the result was just as daunting. I was as numb and drained as if I really could feel something. Deborah was gone. She was in terrible danger of becoming a fascinating work of performance art. And her only hope of maintaining any kind of existence beyond a series of still pictures tacked up on a police lab board was her battered, brain-dead brother. Poor, dog-dumb Dexter, sitting in a chair with his brain running in circles, chasing its tail, howling at the moon. I took a deep breath. Of all the times I had ever needed to be me, this was one of the foremost. I concentrated very hard and steadied me, and as a small amount of Dexter returned to fill the echo in my brain cavity, I realized just how human and stupid I had become. There was really no great mystery here. In fact, it was patently obvious. My friend had done everything but send a formal invitation reading, "The honor of your presence is requested at the vivisection of your sister, Black Heart optional." But even this small blob of logic was wiped out of my throbbing skull by a new thought that wormed its way in, oozing rotten logic. I had been asleep when Deb disappeared. Could that mean that once again I had done it without knowing it? What if I had already taken Deb apart somewhere, stacked the pieces in some small, cold storage room and... Storage room? Where had that come from? The closed-in feeling. The rightness of the closet at the hockey rink. The cool air blowing across my spine. Why did that matter? Why did I keep coming back to that? Because no matter what else happened, I did. I returned to those same illogical sense memories, and there was no reason for them that I could see. What did it mean? And why did I actually give a single hummingbird's fart what it meant? Because whether it meant something or not, it was all I had to go on. I had to find a place that matched that sense of cool and pressing rightness. There was simply no other way to go. Find the box. And there I would find Deb, too. And find either myself or my not-self. Wasn't that simple? No. It wasn't simple at all. Just simple-minded. It made absolutely no sense to pay any attention to the ghostly secret messages floating up at me from my dreams. Dreams had no existence in reality, left no Freddy Krueger crossover claw marks on our wake-up world. I couldn't very well dash out of the house and drive aimlessly around in a psychic funk. I was a cool and logical being, and so it was in a cool and logical manner that I locked my apartment door and strolled to the car. I still had no idea where I was going, but the need to get there quickly had grabbed the reins and whipped me down to the building's parking area where I kept my car. But 20 feet away from my trusty vehicle, I slammed to a stop as though I had run into an invisible wall. The dome light was on. I had certainly not left it on. It had been daylight when I parked, and I could see that the doors were closed tightly. A casual thief would have left the door ajar to avoid the noise from closing it. I approached slowly, not at all sure what I expected to see, or whether I really wanted to see it. From 5 feet away, I could see something in the passenger seat. I circled the car carefully and peered down at it, my nerves tingling, and peeked in. And there it was. Barbie again. I was getting quite a collection. This one was dressed in a little sailor hat and a shirt with a bare midriff and tight pink hot pants. In one hand, she clutched a small suitcase that said Cunard on the side.
I opened the door and picked up the doll. I pulled the little suitcase from Barbie's hand and popped it open. Some small something fell out and rolled onto the floorboard. I picked it up. It looked an awful lot like Deborah's class ring. On the inside of the band was etched DM, Deborah's initials. I collapsed onto the seat, clutching Barbie in my sweaty hands. I turned her over. I bent her legs. I waved her arms.
And what did you do last night, Dexter?
Oh, I played with my dolls while a friend chopped up my sister. I didn't waste any time wondering how Cruise Line Hooker Barbie had gotten into my car. This was clearly a message. Or a clue. But clues really ought to hint at something, and this one seemed to lead in the wrong direction. Clearly he had Debbie. But Cunard? How did that fit in with tight, cold killing space? I could see no connection. But there was really only one place in Miami where it did fit. I drove up Douglas and turned right through Coconut Grove. I had to slow down to thread my way through the parade of happy imbeciles dancing between the shops and cafes. They all seemed to have far too much time and money, and very few clues beyond that. And it took me much longer than it should have to get through them. But it was hard to be too upset, since I didn't actually know where I was going. Onward to somewhere, along Bayfront Drive, over to Brickell, and into downtown. I saw no huge neon signs bedecked with flashing arrows and encouraging words to direct me, "This way to the dissection!" But I drove on, approaching American Airlines Arena and, just beyond, MacArthur Causeway. In the quick glimpse I got on the near side of the arena, I could see the superstructure of a cruise ship in government cut. Not a Cunard Line ship, of course, but I peered anxiously for some sign. It seemed obvious that I wasn't actually being directed onto a cruise ship. Too crowded, too many snooping officials. But somewhere nearby, somewhere related. Which, of course, had to mean what? No further clues. I looked hard enough at the cruise ship to melt the poop deck, but Deborah did not spring from the hold and dance down the gangway. I looked some more. Beside the ship, cargo cranes reared up into the night sky like abandoned props from Star Wars. A little farther, and the stacks of cargo boxes were just barely visible in the dark below the cranes. Great, untidy heaps of them, scattered across the ground as if a gigantic and very bored child had flung out his toy box full of building blocks. Some of the storage boxes were refrigerated. And then beyond these boxes... Back up for just a moment, dear boy. Who was that whispering to me? Muttering what soft words to all alone, darkly driving Dexter? Who sat behind me now? Whose dry chuckling filled the back seat? And why? What message was rattling into my brainless, echo-empty head? Storage boxes. Some of them refrigerated. But why the storage boxes? What possible reason could I have to be interested in a pile of cold, tightly enclosed spaces? Oh, yes. Well, since you put it that way. Could this be the place? The future home of the Dexter's Birthplace Museum? With authentic, lifelike exhibits, including a rare live performance by Dexter's only sister? I yanked my steering wheel hard, cutting off a BMW with a very loud horn. I extended my middle finger, for once driving like the Miami native I was, and accelerated over the causeway.
This ends Disc 6. Darkly Dreaming Dexter. Disc 7.
The cruise ship was off to the left. The area with all the boxes was on the right, surrounded by a chain-link fence topped with razor wire. I drove around one time on the access road, wrestling a rising tide of certainty and a swelling chorus of what sounded like college fight songs from the dark passenger. The road dead-ended at a guard booth well before I got to the containers. There was a gate with several uniformed gentlemen lounging about,
and no way through without answering some fairly embarrassing questions.
"Yes, officer, I wondered if I could come in and look around. You see, I thought it might be a good place for a friend of mine to slice up my sister."
I cut through a line of orange cones in the middle of the road, 30 feet from the gate, and turned around, back the way I had come. The cruise ship loomed on the right now. I turned left just before I came to the bridge, back to the mainland, and drove into a large area with a terminal on one end and a chain-link fence on the other. The fence was gaily decorated with signs that threatened dire punishment to anyone who strayed into the area, signed by U.S. Customs. The fence led back to the main road along a large parking lot, empty at this time of night. I cruised its perimeter slowly, staring at the containers on the far side. These would be from foreign ports, needing to go through customs, access tightly controlled. It would be much too difficult for anyone to get in and out of this area, especially if they were carrying questionable loads of body parts and the like. I would either need to find a different area, or admit that chasing vague feelings dredged up from a series of taunting dreams and a scantily clad doll was a waste of time. And the sooner I admitted that, the better my chance of finding Deb. She wasn't here. There was no reason she should be. At last, a logical thought. I felt better already, and certainly would have been smug about it, if I hadn't seen a familiar panel truck parked right up against the inside of the fence, parked to display the lettering on the side that said Alonzo Brothers. My private crowd in the basement of my brain sang too loudly for me to hear myself smirk, so I pulled over and parked. The clever boy part of me was knocking on the front door of my brain and calling out, "Hurry, hurry, go, go, go!" But around back, the lizard slithered up to the window and flicked its cautious tongue, and so I sat for a long moment before I finally climbed out of the car. I walked to the fence and stood like a bit part actor in a World War II prison camp movie, my fingers locked in the mesh of the fence, peering hungrily at what lay beyond, only a few impossible yards away. I was sure that there must be a very simple way for a marvelously intelligent creature like me to get in, but it was some indication of the state I was in that I couldn't seem to fasten one thought onto another. I had to get in, but I couldn't. And so I stood there, clinging to the fence and looking in, knowing full well that everything that mattered was right there, only a few yards away, and I was completely unable to fling my giant brain at the problem and catch a solution as it bounced back. The mind picks some very bad times to take a walk, doesn't it? My backseat alarm clock went off. I had to move away, and right now. I was standing suspiciously in a well-guarded area, and it was night. Any moment, one of the guards was certain to take an interest in the handsome young man peering intelligently through the fence. I would have to move on and find some way in as I rolled along in my car. I stepped back from the fence, giving it one last loving look. Right there where my feet had touched the fence, a break was barely visible. The fence links had been snipped just enough to allow entry for one human being, or even a good copy like me. The flap was pinned in place by the weight of the parked truck, so it wouldn't swing out and give itself away. It must have been done recently, this evening, since the truck had arrived. My final invitation. I backed away slowly, feeling an automatic "hello there" kind of absent-minded smile climb up on my face as a disguise. "Hello there, officer. Just out for a walk. Lovely evening for a dismemberment, isn't it?" I cheerfully scuffed over to my car, looking around at nothing but the moon over the water, whistling a happy tune as I climbed in and drove away. No one seemed to be paying any attention whatsoever, except, of course, for the hallelujah chorus in my mind. I nudged my car into a parking place over by the cruise ship office, perhaps 100 yards from my little handmade gate into paradise. A few other cars were scattered nearby. No one would pay any mind to mine. But as I parked, another car slid into the spot next to me, a light blue Chevy with a woman behind the wheel. I sat still for a moment. So did she. I opened my door and got out. So did Detective LaGuerta.